Good morning. The House Education Committee will come to order. It's Friday, March 28th, and the time is 8:03 a.m. Today we are joined by Representative Seaton, myself, Representative Gaddis, Representative Reinbold, and Representative Ledoux. We've been joined by Representative Keto. And on our agenda this morning, we have HB 233, Sexual Assault Prevention Programs, and we'll hear HB 93, Charter Schools. So we'll begin with HB 233, and we have the bill sponsor in the audience with us today. And I know she has a special guest with her who will be helping her present the bill. So if they'd like to come forward and introduce yourself, and I want to thank her guest for flying up from the lower 48 and visiting our capital. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And please put yourself on the record and who you may be with.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Representative Garen Tarr. Serve is the House District 17 representative from Anchorage. And really pleased to be here this morning. I'll let Erin introduce herself before I give my opening comments.
I'm Erin Marin from Chicago, Illinois, and I'm traveling state to state to pass what's called Erin's Law.
Thank you. And let the record show that we've been joined by Representative Peggy Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning to everyone on the committee. This bill, Erin's Law, is about child abuse prevention, and it was brought to my attention this fall by a constituent. As Erin mentioned, she's traveling state to state in support of this bill. And so, of course, this idea was brought to my attention. I looked into it. What is it about? And then wanted to look into, well, what's happening in Alaska? Do we already have this law? Do we need this law? And so in establishing whether, you know, child sexual abuse is a problem in Alaska, we looked at the OCS reports, and everyone should have in their packet the Ledge Research Report with these numbers. And in 2013, there were more than 2,296 allegations of child sex abuse, and that represents 1,118 individual victims. And over 40% of these victims were Alaska Native children. So those numbers were alarming to me, and really made me want to look into what we could do. To put this in perspective, if I looked into the number of students at some of the high schools in our area, and you know, 1,118 victims is more than four of Homer High School. It's more than three of Juneau High School, and even for us in Anchorage with some of the bigger schools, it's more than the number of students at Bartlett High School. So it's as if that really gives perspective on the number of children that entire high school and a few hundred more experienced child sexual abuse in 2013 in Alaska. National statistics tell us that one in four girls and one in six boys will be sexually assaulted or abused before age 18, but only one in 10 will tell. And so that's really why this is a silent epidemic, and why doing a program like this to empower children to have a voice, to speak up, to know that there's an adult that will trust them can be so effective, and why we can try and prevent the next generation of children from being abused. After introducing this bill, I've heard from Alaskans all over the state with stories, things that have affected their family personally or their community. One of the most moving was out of an article I read about child sexual abuse in the Bering Straits region, and about a woman who went back to her home community and wanted to talk to people, not actual research in the traditional sense, but more anecdotal, and find out what's happening. And in looking into the numbers, you know, she found out from their child advocacy center in Nome, there were 51 cases of child sexual abuse just in that small region there. So in some areas, you know, much higher than the rates we've even been talking about. So this bill envisions a mandate for all public schools to teach children age-appropriate child sexual abuse prevention curriculum. And it's very focused on that. It's really about thinking about the youngest and the most vulnerable among us, and the children that would be very susceptible to the messages that perpetrators use. Things like, if you tell someone, I'll hurt you, your family will be hurt, you'll hurt your, you know, that no one will believe you, things like that. Children, when they're that young, they're very susceptible and vulnerable to those messages. So this bill would envision a program to empower those children, and it would also add some training that I think would be a complement to the mandatory training that teachers have right now. Teachers are required to take training on being a mandatory reporter if a child discloses child sexual abuse. I think this training that they would get through this bill could be a good complement to that, and it would be more about recognizing the signs and how to appropriately intervene in a way that keeps a child safe. So with that opening introduction, unless there are any questions, I'll turn it over to Erin, who's the inspiration of this bill, and I think everyone will be just as interested as I have been to hear about her travels and what's happening in the other states, and even the early results that show how effective this can be. Thank you.
Thank you all for having me. As I said, I come from Chicago, Illinois, and I am taking this bill across the country because children are not just being abused in my home state of Illinois. They're being abused around this world. But it's that silent epidemic we don't talk about. We look the other way, pretend it's not going on, when I guarantee every single one of you in this room knows somebody that has been affected by sexual abuse. But the scars are invisible, and the stigma and shame that is placed on this issue, we don't talk about it as a society. We'll talk about juvenile diabetes, cancer, autism, bullying. But this is one of those things as a society that continues to go on because we fail to address it. As you heard, 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused by the age of 18. Well, I was one of those children, going off to my very first sleepover as a little kindergartner with my best friend. She lived in the home with a single parent, just her mom, a little brother, and an uncle that lived in the home and acted as the caretaker while mom worked. And it was at this overnight, this man came into the room and woke me up when I was sleeping and sexually abused me for the very first time. Did I have the language to go home and tell my mom as that little 6-year-old what this man had done? No, I didn't. I didn't know how to speak up and tell and explain to her or my father what had happened. So I kept it a secret. Well, as we know with these perpetrators, they don't stop. They'll continue to abuse a child and keep them silent as long as possible until they get caught. And that was the case for me. From 6, 7, 8 years old, this man repeatedly, times I went over to her house overnights, sexually abused, and eventually raped me as nearly a 7-year-old. The only message I got from this man was, "This is our little secret. I know where you live. If you tell anybody, I'll come get you." So I stayed silent. I lived in that fear because that was the only message I got, being brainwashed to think that he would come get me, nobody would believe me. All the red flags were there. Suddenly that sweet little kid that I was began to act out. Suddenly they had to hold me back, repeat first grade. They had to have one-on-one aid that constantly was working with me because of the tantrums I threw in school, putting my hand through a window. The anger that I had was very relevant that something was going on. But no one was asking those important questions, teaching me on safe touch, unsafe touch, safe secrets, unsafe secrets. So they eventually labeled me with an IEP, Individual Education Plan, with behavior an emotionally disturbed child. So as this continued to go on throughout my childhood, not speaking up about it, all the behavior problems there, what finally made this end? Well, it wasn't somebody coming into the classroom and teaching me like they had been with Stranger Danger. Not look for that lost puppy, don't take candy from the stranger. Yet 93% of the time, children are sexually abused by someone they love and trust. I guarantee you, if you get a room full of parents and you ask them if they've talked to their kids about Stranger Danger, every hand will go up. Sure, every one of you that's a parent in this room has talked to your kids about Stranger Danger. But when it comes to sexual abuse prevention, that if someone is ever inappropriately touching you in the areas that are covered by your swimsuit, you speak up and tell. Rarely does a hand go up when I ask parents that. And usually that one hand or that two hands that do go up, it's because that mother or father was sexually abused as a child by somebody they knew and trusted. So at 8.5 years old, I found out we were moving. I was getting away from this perpetrator, this man that had done these awful things to me that I was still keeping a secret about. Started a new school, but of course, as I made new friends, I never wanted to spend the night because I feared the men in their home. Only, unfortunately, to get that much closer to my next perpetrator in my life. Was it that man that pulled up in that rusty van, that stranger, asking me to take candy out of his hand? That man that walked up with the leash, asking if I've seen that lost puppy? No. Not that Stranger Danger that I had been warned about. This time it was a family member. At age 11, waking up in the middle of the night, to this older teenage cousin sexually abusing me. And of course, the abuse didn't end after once. It went on from age 11, 12, 13, birthday parties, Christmas, Thanksgiving, and soon it happened weekly while we were over at their house because they lived just down the street from me. This cousin repeatedly told me, "This is our little secret. No one will believe you. If you tell anybody you have no proof that I'm doing this, you will destroy our family." This is the only message I was getting, once again, as a child growing up. But I knew how to run out of that burning building, duck and cover from a tornado, evacuate that school bus, and as you guys do here in Alaska, the earthquake drills that we don't have in Illinois. We drill these kids with all this powerful information on safety, but this is one thing we failed to address with kids. I also learned in sixth grade for 6 weeks the 8 ways to say no to drugs. I still got my little DARE card here. And I can tell you all right now, I have not so much as put a cigarette in my mouth because I know the consequences to doing drugs and smoking. Because I was repeatedly told. I never caved to the peer pressure. Because I was continuously told by a police officer for 6 weeks the consequences to this. But the only message I got growing up as a kid was to stay silent and listen to my perpetrator. And of course, the school poured thousands of dollars into me with resources because of my behavior problems that nobody knew were going on at home. I kept my secrets locked away in a little childhood diary. And I'm going to read to you just one little passage which I was reading as an adult that made me go on this crusade to pass this law in every state. I sobbed the whole way home. Over and over my head, I thought about what just happened. In school, a guy called Officer Friendly teaches us about strangers. Never answer the door when my parents are gone. I thought people, like Brian, jumped out of bushes and attacked you at night. They don't teach you in school about your own family. It was those words that I realized they don't teach us in school about the people you know and trust that can hurt you. And there are kids across this world that's the only message they're getting. I can give you the perfect example of what happened in Pennsylvania with Jerry Sandusky. That one little boy that had been abused back in 1998 knew how to speak up and tell because he had been educated. How many more kids for the next decade could have been saved, put that man away, but instead the only message they got was from Jerry Sandusky? Because you see, these perpetrators will victimize as many kids as they can get away with. The average sex offender in a lifetime has 114 victims. Think about that for a moment. And the other startling statistic is there are 42 million survivors of sexual abuse in America alone. 3 million of those are children. Those 3 million kids could fill 46 national football stadiums. But we often can't put a face to these kids because the physical signs are not there that they're being abused. So I have made it my life mission to go out there and put a face and voice on this silent epidemic and give children the voice that I never had as a kid. These men had stolen my innocence, they took my trust, but the one thing I've been able to reclaim from them is my voice. And I've decided to turn this into something positive instead of negative and do something good for kids and giving that 7-year-old that's being raped tonight by her stepfather the ability to go report it tomorrow at school instead of being repeatedly abused the way I was as a child and not coming forward until she's in her 30s and in drug rehab, finally telling somebody why she turned to substance abuse, why they turned to the eating disorder, the self-injury, the suicide attempt. You see, hearing these statistics, you know it's a national epidemic. And what finally gave me my voice at 13 years old wasn't that educator coming into the classroom and teaching me about sexual abuse prevention. It was finding out that my little 11-year-old sister was also being sexually abused by this same family member. You see, they don't stop. They'll get away with this for as long as possible. So I've taken this crusade state to state. I resigned from my full-time master's level job as a counselor in Illinois to go after this law, to convince legislators that we need to give kids a voice. It was passed yesterday where I testified 3 weeks ago in Tennessee, making it the 12th state to pass this law. There are currently 26 more states that are currently voting on it, and I've literally been traveling this month alone to 4 states now, Alaska being the fourth, and will travel to 3 or 4 more next month to testify to legislators to get this law passed so that we give kids a voice in every state. Because as I tell people, this epidemic is not going to end. And while I would hate to to sit there and put this responsibility on kids to speak up and tell. We can't rely on parents to sit there and have this conversation, because often the perpetrator is in the home, or as I said, parents don't know how to have this conversation. There are people in the schools where it will cost nothing to educate kids. You have here in Alaska your health teachers. I spoke with the superintendent when I arrived here in Anchorage, and they've been doing this for 15 years in numerous of their schools. The health educators, who are already salaried positions, coming in and teaching the kids this. In my home state of Illinois, we've been using the social workers and psychologists that have been going into the classrooms and teaching kids this. They've been learning it all year in my home state since it passed, and they've already had several disclosures. One case, a police department called me and said, a girl that had been repeatedly abused for several years by a family member finally came forward. They were fortunate to get a confession out of this man. And when they asked this 12-year-old what finally made her speak up after all this time, she said it was because they taught us Aaron's Law in school that day. She waited after class and told her teacher. As I say, if this law can save just one child in every state, and give them a voice and end their horror, then it's well worth my passion and mission to go to every state and pass this law. I certainly hope you will hear my message today and support this law, because as I tell legislators, I won't stop in getting this law passed in every single state. I will come pound on your doors. You'll continue to see me until we pass this law. I certainly hope you don't make me come back here with a newborn, travel another 6.5-hour flight, because this has definitely been the farthest state I've had to travel to pass this law. I certainly hope that you see the importance of it, because as I say, the true people that should really, you know, the only ones that should really be voting against this law are the ones that have something to hide, the ones that want to harm our kids. So I appreciate you guys hearing my message today, and I hope you will pass House Bill 233. The governor supports it. He told me when I arrived, you have my full support. So I hope you will see the importance of it. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for your testimony. I can tell with your passion, there's going to be more than 12 states, and I really, really appreciate it. Thank you for visiting me yesterday. She was just as passionate yesterday, and I have no doubt as she visits the other states, she will continue with that passion. Do we have any questions or comments from the committee? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was a school nurse for many years. And when I was in North Carolina, I came across situations where someone finally told me, and I had to turn them in and everything. And it's very difficult if you don't have social services that will come in and do what needs to be have happen at the time. But I really, really appreciate you doing that. It's not easy to come forward and tell people your story. So thank you very much. And what kind did you get any kind of counseling or anything that helped, because you seem so with it right now? And
yes, I did. I often tell people, you know, you can't get through this without the counseling, the help, because I did go down that very destructive path, as I, you know, said often, you know, that little kid's being abused is going to turn to drugs. I didn't turn to drugs, but, you know, I turned to self-injury, an eating disorder. And finally, as I said, decided to do something positive instead of continuing to harm myself and go down that destructive path.
Good for you. Thank you.
Seeing no other comments or questions, we'll ask the department if they have any comments, concerns, questions, if they'd like to come forward. If they don't, then don't. Okay. And we'll let the department come to the podium. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And again, if you'll please introduce yourself and who you're with for the record. Thank you.
Susan McCauley, Director of Teaching and Learning Support for the Department of Education and Early Development. Wanted to mention that while we do currently have in regulation requirements for the annual training for school personnel regarding sexual assault and abuse reporting, as was mentioned by the sponsor and by Aaron, we do not have in regulation currently language as specific as in this bill regarding the training of children. We have some broad language regarding safe touch, but it does not to the degree that this bill does require that on an annual basis across the grade levels as part of a school district's developed curriculum.
And I guess I would ask what the administration thinks about this bill. Do they think that we should incorporate it? Are they neutral? Where are you?
Certainly, regarding the statistics that are well established in the state of Alaska and were cited here this morning, we recognize this as a serious problem, and we certainly are in support of measures that are going to do everything we can as educators to help ensure that students are safe. We also have in regulation language that would be consistent with this bill regarding the local control over the development of curricula. And there's nothing in this bill that I see that would get in the way of that. It does not prescribe any particular curriculum. It mentions the language age appropriate, and it would prescribe to districts, as is consistent with our own regulation, the responsibility for the development of that curriculum at the local level.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can see we're in the bigger school districts that there would be personnel that that are paid now to go ahead and teach this. When I was a nurse in North Carolina, I actually taught that, and I'm kind of surprised to realize that that must have been pretty new at the time, and I wasn't even aware that it was. But I would actually have the kids practice, you know, saying no, and then go get out of there, and then go tell someone. But my concern is, I think maybe some teachers need to be trained in this because of the fact that in the smaller schools, there we don't have the extra personnel to be able to do that. And I'm thinking of villages and areas like that. So I hope that the department will take that into consideration and maybe at least make up a little program that's online or something so that a teacher can see what it says and have good instructions so that it can be done in all areas of the state.
Thank you. And for the record, I'd like to note that Representative Sadler has joined us quite some time ago, and I did not notice him. Representative Ledoux.
So can I assume that when you say that there is nothing in this bill that is inconsistent with the regulations that the department has, that by that you mean that the department supports this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we're certainly in support of measures that are going to ensure the safety of students in Alaskan schools. Just to qualify or clarify perhaps my statement, when I say there is nothing that is inconsistent, our established practice in Alaska regarding curriculum development, and this is unlike other states in the country, is that that responsibility is at the local level. And very clearly on page 1, line 10, this bill says the governing body of each school district shall, and then prescribes what shall occur. So that the language here, the approach taken here, is consistent with our approach in general regarding curriculum in Alaska, and certainly the department supports measures to ensure the safety of our children in Alaskan schools.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question from me is on the curriculum development. Are there curriculums out there that are readily available so that every district isn't going to have to start de novo and generate a curriculum for the training?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, my guess is that the bill sponsor and Aaron in particular would be more knowledgeable about specific curricula. My professional guess is that there are established curricula that are available that districts could consider rather than developing their own, so to speak. There are very likely established curricula in these areas.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to have Aaron come up to ask those questions.
And thank you. Do we have any other questions for the administration before we, Representative Sadler?
Thank you very much. Just curious if you might have any estimate as to what the costs might be for the mandatory policy development and staff training.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the staff training component already exists. The department has provided training materials through an e-learning module that we make available to districts. It has already required the annual training of staff. So there would be no costs involved there with regard to those training materials. I don't see related costs at the department level related to our role in this bill.
Sure, follow-up.
Follow-up.
So there would be no associated cost with additional training materials. What about time?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, from the department's perspective, I do not see any costs that would be incurred by the department related to this.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
So we're going to go back to my original question. You've used the term the administration supports measures like this. So I guess maybe I am trying to put you on the spot a little bit, but yes or no, does the administration support this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we are in support of the bill.
Thank you.
Any other questions for administration? Thank you, Dr. McCauley. And we'd love to have Erin back up to put her on the hot seat. She does such a great job of it, too. So thank you.
I've never done this before.
Well, you're very good at it, you know. And for us to potentially be the 13th state, I don't think we're afraid of that number 13. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Erin, is there a curriculum, you know, that a canned curriculum that we can just put, like the department could put online, so that that's using proven methods that we know work?
There's numerous curriculum out there that can be, I mean, I have it even on my website, of the different programs that are used that schools can, you know, get on and use and look at all the different grade levels. And I know even in Anchorage, they have curriculum that they're more than willing to, you know, provide and give their background on what they've done in the different schools throughout the state to help, you know, the state get this. Because as I said, they've been doing this for 15 years, which is incredible to see that, you know, they have been doing something about it before, you know, having to come here and get, you know, get it going to get it passed in a mandate. But yes, there are numerous curriculum out there everywhere from Canada. Two great programs in Canada, and throughout from, you know, New Jersey CAP program to the Washington, out of Seattle, Washington, talk about touching with the Department of Education, highly recommends. I mean, there's several programs out there that I recommend, so yes.
Thank you.
Representative Tito.
And Madam Chair, I don't know if you have in your packets, we do have an amendment that actually adds a task force into the bill that would within the Department of Safety, create a group of people that could help school districts identify specific curriculum for the training programs.
Thank you, Representative Quito. Are there any other questions or comments for Erin before we let her go back, but not too far back there, I could tell. No more questions. Let's go online to those that would like to speak to this bill. Thank you, Erin. Next, we have Rachel Gurnett from Palmer, who I happen to know, and thank you, Rachel, for waiting online.
Thank you.
And Rachel, if you'll introduce yourself and who you may be with for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rachel Gurnett. I am a resident in Palmer in the Mattoo Valley, and I'm a former prosecutor for the state of Alaska, and now I currently own a business that actually somewhat addresses what this bill is on. It has to do with training in the area of sex abuse, sex assault, and domestic violence. I spent 12 years as a prosecutor for the state of Alaska, most of those in the Mattoo Valley, but around the state to include Anchorage, Nome, Costa View, Glen Allen, Cordova, and Valdez. And I was a sex crimes prosecutor for almost my entire career, prosecuting the sex crime in the Valley. So I have spoken to more victims than I can count about child sexual abuse. I can tell you that in my entire career, I have never had one child report after the first time they were abused. The abuse was always long-term. It was chronic. It was hidden. It was most of the time in the home or in a home where they frequented. It was nobody knew, and children often felt they had told. And when I would talk to kids and about the case and whatever stage we were in the prosecution, we'd always ask about, you know, when was the first time you told? And they would tell about a time that they tried to tell, but what they thought was telling was not what adults thought was telling. And they would always say, well, no one believed me. No one listened to what I had to say. And it wasn't till they would either tell a friend or somebody would walk in on it that they would find out what happened. Since I still keep in touch with many of the victims, some will elect to keep in touch with me since the prosecution of the case. And as adults, they will tell me about more abuse than they even wanted to disclose when they had told the first time. I now have a business that has a couple different prongs to it, but one of it is that I go into the schools and I talk about internet safety education, and by the school's request, cyberbullying and sexting. And I also have children of my own in public schools, and so I'm in the schools all the time. And I can tell that when I do the presentations on cyberbullying and sexting, almost every single time, a student will come up to me, regardless of the age, and tell me about something that happened online or ask me a question about something that happened to them or that they saw online. So if children are willing to come forward in just hearing a speech on cyberbullying and sexting, what we could do, the disclosures that could be made by giving them the education and the safety net to tell when they're being sexually raped every night, is just the thoughts of that would be wonderful. The thought, as Aaron said, that we could even save one child. That's how I felt in my career. If I could save one child, if I can put one perpetrator in jail, I can let one little child go home at night and sleep safe at night, then I've done my job. When I saw Representative Carr's bill, I actually reached out to her and told her what I did in my experience and said, this is a phenomenal bill. We have to be in the schools. We have to teach children that it's okay to tell, and we have to give educators the skills that they need to be able to recognize it. I mean, we put so much on teachers to recognize what's going on and to manage children in school, and I didn't know that part about Erin with her IEP, but it makes so much sense. Kids don't know how to deal with this. Adults don't know how to deal with this, and I think it's our responsibility as a state to give our children that. I just spent today, last night in Petersburg for the Governor's Choose Respect marches, and just to hear students talk about things that go on in their school, this is part of respect. This is part of choosing respect and respect for our children, and I hope that our government here in Alaska will listen to Aaron and to his people and pass this bill. So thank you.
And thank you, Rachel, and thank you for all the great work that you've done in the MATSU. Next, we'll go to Trevor Storrs. Trevor, are you with us?
Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you, Trevor, if you'll tell us your name and who you may be with for the record.
Absolutely. I'm Trevor Storrs, and I'm the executive director of the Alaska Children's Trust. And the Children's Trust is the lead statewide organization focused on the prevention of child abuse and neglect. And for nearly two decades, we have been striving to ensure all Alaska children are raised in safe and secure and nurturing communities. And I'm here to speak on this law because children are one of the greatest resources in Alaska. Each year, we have nearly 12,000 babies born in our state. That makes up about 25% of our Alaska population being under the age of 18. Unfortunately, many of these children do not live in a safe, supportive, and nurturing environment. Alaska has one of the highest per capita rates of child abuse and neglect in the country. OCS in 2012 completed over 10,000 children initial assessments. 65% of infants and toddlers in Alaska have at least one risk factor known to increase the chance of poor health, school, and developmental outcomes. 29% of the children in Alaska who are maltreated are under the age of 3. And 37% of the children entering foster care are also under the age of 3. This is a sign that we have an epidemic in our state. And the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study shows that children who experience trauma like child abuse or neglect, have a greater risk of experiencing some of the social, behavioral, and physical ills that plague our community, like obesity, diabetes, domestic violence, substance abuse, not graduating from high school, or entering the correctional system. Many issues that we've all been struggling with. We know that Alaska is in the top five in the nation for many of these health issues. Aaron's Law is one step closer to helping us to achieve two critical components to ensure all Alaska children are safe. One, reduce trauma, and build resiliency. This year, that silence that Aaron was talking about was definitely broken here in Alaska. Children at the Elder and Youth Conference at AFN spoke out about the abuse they were experiencing in their village, Hamanoff, including sexual abuse. They had state troopers follow in with them to ensure that the audience, family members, other leaders of their communities did not storm the stage and ensure their safety. One child was even told, don't bother coming home if you speak out against your family. In their honor, let's look and pass this law. If they can break the silence, so can you. So can we. We support Aaron's Law. We specifically support the task force being adopted. And as a funding agent, we would consider looking at a proposal to assist with that task force in the sense of cost. No dollar amount can be determined, and it needs to go before the board of directors, but we would strongly encourage an application for such support. And the reason we support the task force is there are curriculums that are out there that are outdated and are actually no longer good, i.e. Safe Touch doesn't always teach everything that the children need to know. So to ensure that this law is just not something on the books and people just do something to meet that requirement, that they truly take it for what it is of changing the culture within their system and ensuring the safety of the children, the task force is critical. I thank you all for hearing my testimony, but most importantly, for listening to Aaron today. It is, unfortunately, we do not have an Alaskan sitting before you to share their experiences, and we have many, many Alaskans that could share that story, but are scared to still break that silence. Help us today to shatter that silence.
And thank you, Trevor. I too, am glad that somebody came forward, and I do appreciate Aaron coming forward. Rachel, are you still on the line? Rachel,
yes.
And thank you for holding on. I may have zoomed a little bit quicker than I should have. We do have a legislator that would like to ask a question. Representative Reinbold.
Hi, and thank you very much for your testimony today. I have a question. There's a lot of these cases that can happen in villages. It can happen anywhere in any community. And I kind of want to focus on the other side of the equation, not the victim right now, but the perpetrator, because you're a prosecutor. And I believe there has to be serious consequences to the perpetrator. And right now the courts have to be aware and be very aggressive against these individuals. There has to be either rehabilitation or a very strong message that we as legislators put forth for the perpetrator. So basically what I'm trying to find out, I don't want Alaska to be a safe haven. What kind of message can we put forth as legislators, you know, to try to really criminalize this behavior and not make Alaska a safe haven for these individuals?
Sure. You all, you're exactly, did you want me to respond,
Madam Chair? Yes, please.
You're exactly correct. One of the things that has happened in March of 2006 when the legislature passed the higher penalties for sex offenders, that was a huge move towards not being a safe haven for sex offenders. We had moved from sentences in the 2 to 8 year range into the 15 to 35 year range for sex offenders. And since that bill, I can tell you that I personally had sex offenders sentenced to sentences that they will never be released from prison based on the length of their sentences, which prior to 2006 never would have happened. So in that sense, we are moving forward. I think, in my experience, a large problem that occurs is bail releases. It's one thing to have someone sentenced to 25, 45 years upon conviction, but until that conviction happens, a lot of times people are placed back out on bail with their third-party person who's supposed to be watching them 24 hours a day, and they're released back into their community where the victim lives. And as you pointed out, it's, you know, that's different if you're talking about Anchorage or Fairbanks, if you're talking about, you know, Selawik or Nome or Barrow, where people are going back to their small communities and the victims are there. And so that would be a support for victims. That sometimes it's until conviction that victims are believed, and then even after that, that's not true. So the support we have to support victims from their disclosure until a conviction would go a long way to speaking out that we are not going to allow this to happen in our community. And then the other would be just public awareness. There's still a shame in wanting to talk about it, and it still puts a lot of burden on the victim. And just as we're doing in the other areas of sexual assault, we need to make sexual abuse and perpetrators of sexual abuse more prevalent, the awareness of that more prevalent in our community.
Thank you, Rachel. And we do have a follow-up, Representative Reinbold.
Rachel, thank you very much. And if you have anything for legislators, you know, if we need to address any of the lawyers, you know, the defense lawyers, the courts, anything in penalty, anywhere where you see a loophole, if you wouldn't mind just putting it forth, because this is something we definitely need to address as a state. It's one of the saddest things that happen in our state. And if there's anything you can do to help us address this, please feel free to send it to us. So thank you.
And, Rachel, if you do have that information, this is Representative Gaddis. If you'll send it to my office, we'll certainly make sure that the committee gets a copy of anything that you may have set forward. Are there any other questions for Rachel? Thanks again, Rachel. We'll go to Mike Coons. Mike?
Yes, thank you.
And, Mike, I think you know the drill. Please introduce yourself and who you may be with for the record.
Yes, this is Mike Coons from Palmer. I'm speaking, and I sat here and I listened to Aaron, and I think, like all of you, my blood was boiling. I'm speaking from this from the standpoint as a retired paramedic, and I have seen far too many abuses from just physical abuse to sexual abuse. And as a paramedic in Ohio, the one that I remember the most from a possible sexual abuse, we took it to social services, and we as the reporters were treated worse than we were treated like we were the criminal. I don't know. I understand since then that Alaska social services is better than that. But I have a real foul taste in my mouth about what social services does or doesn't do. As far as what Rachel was talking about, I think, you know, the adults have a hard enough time figuring out things. The states, not just Alaska, but the states have got this real problem of we gotta rehabilitate these individuals, and we have to give them life sentences. And I'm glad to see that we went from 2 to 8 to 15 to 35. But the problem is, as Aaron was saying, how many children have been abused by each one of these perpetrators, these pedophiles, the scum of the earth, before they even get caught. So as far as I'm concerned, during the course of the investigation they find out that this is more than just one child, that 15 to 35 needs to go to life without the possibility of parole. We need to find a 20-foot hole, put them down in it, and pipe sunshine down to them when we think about it. So the last thing I'll say, and it kind of really, you know, made me a little angry, I was really saddened that testimony from the Department of Early Education wouldn't answer an emphatic yes when she was asked the question by Representative Ledoux. It took several times to have that drawn out, and I found that quite sad, if not telling. So I really support this as a paramedic professional and as a adult. I don't have any children, but by God, if that ever happened to my kid, the state would better get their hands on that sucker real fast, because I'll have some say about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. And next we'll go to Matthew Hirschfeld. Matthew?
Hello?
Good morning. If you'll please put your name on the record and who you may be with.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, for having me testify this morning. So my name is Matthew Hirschfeld. I'm a pediatrician in Anchorage, and I'm representing the All-Alaska Pediatric Partnership, which is one of the major organizations in the state that represents healthcare professionals and healthcare organizations focusing on children's issues. And I'm the co-chair of the All-Alaska Pediatric Partnership. And what we fully support this bill and the amendment, especially to help people get trained in how to do that, and how to teach kids age-appropriate awareness of sexual touch and things like that. And basically, our group is focused on the first 1,000 days of life, and we are focusing on that because that is a time of life where you really have the maximum ability to impact children and families, to make sure that children are really ready to enter school and become productive students and then productive adults afterwards. And we're trying, and one of the things that we're looking at is similar to what Trevor Storrs talked about earlier, which is teaching resiliency and trying to minimize trauma in this age group. And nothing introduces trauma to kids as much as sexual abuse, and it is a lifelong issue. And Aaron's testimony was so moving earlier today. As a pediatrician, I see lots of kids who have been abused, and I see the lifelong health issues that result from that. And from the All-Alaska Pediatric Partnership, we fully support this bill and the amendment, and I really appreciate you having me by to testify.
Thank you, and thank you for your testimony. Next, we'll go to the Ketchikan LIO, Vivian Benson.
Hello.
Thank you, and if you'll put your name on the record and who you may be with.
Vivian Benson, and I'm with Women in Safe Homes, and we do support Aaron's Law, but I'm also going to defer this to Diane Gubitayo, as she's here with me. So.
Okay, thank you, Vivian. And next we have Diane, and I'm not going to even try to pronounce her last name. I'll let her do that. Diane, again, if you'll put yourself on the record and who you may be with.
Thank you. It is Diane Gubitayo, and I'm with Women in Safe Homes here in Ketchikan. And we've been, as Vivian said, we highly support this bill. We run the emergency shelter here for victims and survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault here in Ketchikan. And I think I hear from the advocates all the time that it's just so difficult to keep repairing the damage, and we so highly recognize that we need to do more in the field of prevention and education. And we have not much more to add to Aaron's eloquent testimony here, except that we have a member of our community who stepped up recently in a very high-profile case here in Alaska, and the perpetrator was finally convicted after years of perpetration and countless victims. And she finally had the courage to give a public voice because she lost two sisters to suicide who were molested by the same perpetrator. And she tried as a child to find help. But I believe this bill, she was highly supported. It's too bad she's not here today to share her story, but I'm going to be her voice today. This is what her point was. She said, we need to listen to children. We need to give them a voice. And we believe this bill supports that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next, we have Ron Fuhrer. Ron, are you with us?
Yes. Good morning. My name is Ron Fuhrer. I'm president of NEA Alaska. And I'd like to start by commending Aaron for championing this legislation nationwide. And I'd also like to thank Representative Tarr for sponsoring this legislation. On behalf of NEA Alaska's 13,000 education support professionals and teachers, as well as Alaska's 130,000 public school students, I'm voicing support for HB 233, Aaron's Law. As education professionals, student safety is of the highest concern. From the moment students step onto the school bus in the morning until the time they finish their extracurricular activities in the evening, Alaska's most precious and valuable resource is in our care. It is our job to make sure their learning environment is safe and to prepare them to protect themselves in the wider world. Sexual assault, abuse prevention, and awareness programs are a key component of keeping Alaska's children safe. Such programs allow Alaskan educators to recognize the signs of such violence more quickly and provide an immediate and direct route of aid for students. It is important that every Alaskan child knows that he or she can speak out to find safety from sexual abuse and sexual assault. As educators, our student safety always comes first. We wholeheartedly urge the passage of HB 233, which would mandate sexual assault and abuse awareness and prevention in Alaska schools. Thank you to Representative Lynn Gaddis and the House Education Committee for taking the time to address this most important issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. Are there any other folks that are at our LIOs or off-net? With that, we have a few in the audience. Could we have Karen Robinson? Are you in the? Thank you. And please come forward and introduce yourself and who you may be with for the record, and thank you.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, first of all, thank you for working so early in the morning. It does take a lot to get up to get here by 8. For the record, my name is Karen Robinson, and I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Alaska Women's Lobby. The mission of the lobby is to defend and advance the rights and needs of women and children and families in Alaska. We strongly support preventing sexual and domestic violence against children. Many of our lobby steering committee members are, of course, all grandmothers today, but we were young women back in the 70s and 80s who helped design some of the early programs used in our schools today. Many of us were also victims. We appreciate the efforts of Representative Tarr to assure that all children from benefit from these preventive efforts. Today, with the support of Governor Parnell, the Council on Domestic Violence, and most important, with the leadership of Lori Martin, you have a vibrant council and a competent staff to help you carry out this policy. I'm sure most of you know that it is their statutory authority. Their leadership has already been advanced prevention efforts like Alaska Men Choose Respect, Stand Up, Speak Up, and the Alaska 4th R. That should obviously give you some comfort. I think most of us has the same vision when it comes to domestic violence and sexual assault, and that vision is stopping it. We've come a long way, but we have taken a long time, and we have a long ways to go. Alaska from the start was unique. We insisted that a new state council on domestic violence and sexual assault be under the Department of Public Safety. This put Alaska years ahead of the nation in recognizing that women and children victims are not sick and in need of mental health treatment. They are victims needing medical assistance and police support just like any other victims. We recognize that stopping domestic violence begins with education. Many communities from across the state continue to lead the nation by offering comprehensive services in our schools, educating parents, teachers, kids with a K-12 curriculum. For example, as I understand it, we have strong programs in Bethel, Kenai, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, to name a few. But we must do more. There is a glaring need for additional statewide education, identification, and treatment services for children experiencing problems with domestic violence and abuse in their families. School prevention education programs are necessary effort, a major change in the next generation attitudes, and to give information to many children who are experiencing or witnessing physical or sexual abuse. In the beginning, the number of children who came forward after hearing presentations were overwhelming. But we were not prepared for whom would be amongst the perpetrators. Directors of youth centers, assistant attorney general who was helping a group of us rewrite child abuse laws, president of school board, ministers, fathers, brothers, our family members and friends, and lead sexual assault investigator in the town of Juneau. and let you know at that point we didn't have the great law we have today regarding the statute of limitations. That case, the person was let off scot-free because we didn't have that in place. It used to be you had to tell within 5 years. And now with the work of the legislature and the governor and others, we have no statutory limitation any longer. But today, with all the work of the past 30 years, physicians routinely ask children if they are safe at home. Teachers are required to report suspected abuse. Many children learn about the difference between good touch and bad touch. Reports of domestic violence result in arrest. Offenders are locked up. Shelters exist throughout Alaska and the nation. Women are still telling their stories. The governor, the legislature, the law enforcement, school, and health providers have responded. Victims in this state are really no longer alone. But now it's time for passage of House Bill 233 to fill the gaps and make sure all children, no matter what school they attend, get this important information that could change their lives forever. And I just wanted to kind of share with you, because it's history, but it's not as if we haven't done the work in this state. This was designed, and a person who was got a contract through the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault to develop this curriculum many years ago. And also with the help of Bruce Johnson, who's in the audience today, who was the superintendent of the juvenile school districts back in the 80s, who had the vision with many of us to develop what was called the Youth Network Curriculum, in which we had a three-pronged approach where we went in first and educated the teachers, and then we had a parent night in which we educated the parents, and then we went in and talked to all the kids in the schools. And it was amazing, and it was unfortunate, but within the first couple of years of implementing this program, we had over 80 cases in 2 years of kids reporting. Unfortunately for those kids, the investigator I'm talking about was the investigator, and most of those kids never got the chance that many deserve to have. And I have to admit, I'm haunted by all of their, what happened to those children. I do know many of them ended up, I know a couple have committed suicide. I know many of them ended up in jail. I know some of them have ended up in alcohol treatment programs. And I hope we can help change that pattern and support the Aaron's Law and support Representative Tarr in getting House Bill 333 through the legislature. Thank you. And if anybody wants to look at these, I'll put them up for you, pass them around for you to look at them.
And thank you for your testimony. next, we have Allison It might be your handwriting. I'm not going to say anything, but Allison, if you'll please introduce yourself for the record and who you may be with.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Allison Curry. I'm here representing Planned Parenthood Votes Northwest and testifying in support of this bill, and also would like to thank Representative Tarr for her leadership on this very important issue. As a healthcare provider and sex educator, we know that healthy sexuality education is an integral part of violence prevention. The more information a student or teacher has about sexual violence, the more likely they are to identify sexual abuse and assault when it occurs. Teachers need the skills to recognize victims of abuse, and students need tools of their own to evaluate potential risks for sexual violence in their relationships. Discussing sexuality can also make those experiencing sexual abuse or assault feel more comfortable about speaking up and getting help. With proper training, teachers can also be better equipped to offer their support and resources to students in need. Additionally, we strongly believe that sexual violence prevention efforts should take the extra step beyond discussion of abuse and assault and explain what safe, consensual, and respectful relationships look like. Evidence-based curricula in this area are essential to teaching students and educators the difference between healthy and unhealthy sexual behaviors. Eradicating something as culturally pervasive as sexual violence starts with dialogue and awareness. This bill takes a great first step by educating both students and teachers about the warning signs of sexual abuse and assault, and I hope that you will support this bill. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify? Seeing nobody, we'll close public testimony. We'll come back to the committee. Do we have any questions, comments? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I think we all have known that this has been a problem. It is really good to see a solution come out. I mean, the solution to kids only getting the message of you got to be silent, to if kids are educated in that's not appropriate to keep those things silent, then I think that we are on a good path towards prevention, and also the entire community will be aware that that is the message that kids are getting, and so hopefully that will cut down on some of people thinking that they can keep victims silent as well. So, you know, I'm supportive of this.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. I think myself, and I appreciate Aaron bringing it out, but, you know, when we see kids acting up in school, we see some of these issues. I don't know that it's the first thing that comes to mind. Certainly I know that there are teachers that come up with, and no, I mean, I think it's communities. I'm not going to go so far as to say just teachers, that we think of ADHD. We think of a lot of other issues. I don't think the first thing that comes to mind may be some of these issues. So I really appreciate that. And as Alaska struggles with our suicide rate, I think this in turn goes hand in hand. I think the timing was good for Erin. I don't know if she did it on purpose to come of our choose respect, but I think it truly goes hand in hand with choosing respect for Alaskans. So I do appreciate the timing. And with that, I thought Representative Peggy Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, actually, this is very exciting because of the fact that we do have a tendency. We've looked at all around the symptoms and have tried to figure out how to help people and kids and adults. And this might be a key that will, in the long run, help many, many people in many, many ways. And we may see kids doing so much better in school, in the world, just generally all over. And hopefully, Alaska is first in so many things that aren't good. You know, we're first in domestic violence, we're first in suicide, we're the first in sexual abuse, we're just the first of so many. And wouldn't it be wonderful if this was in doing this, that we would see over, I'm sure it takes several years, but over time we would see that we are no longer first in many of those things. I think this is an extreme an extremely insightful something that I had never thought of before in that way, and then in because of that, it's exciting. I think this is a good bill, and I think that we really need to do something, and we need to do it now. Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
I think this bill is really a great bill. I think it's truly a step in the right direction. Erin is absolutely right. Kids are taught all the time, beware of strangers. Don't get candy from strangers. And yet she's correct. Most of this happens within the family and with people that they know. It's not the boogeyman coming out in the middle of the night. It's somebody that you think is your friend. So I definitely support this bill.
Thank you. Representative Quito.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the Representative Tarr for introducing the bill. I very much appreciate Aaron being here, especially this time of the session, getting close to the end and being able to help move this bill forward. The Juneau School District has been a great school district for my daughter. I think they've got great curriculum, and I do think that those successes in our schools in the state should be extended to other places in the state. So I support this bill wholeheartedly. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. I actually support this bill a lot. And what my concerns are is that when these people come forth, when the teachers come forth, when they come on, the perpetrator is going to be around somewhere. What is our plan of action to deal with them? Do we have an aggressive enough plan of action in place to protect these children? And that's where my concern is now. So I'm hoping that this is going to go a step further and to ensure that we have a plan in place and send a terrible message that this is not a safe haven, Alaska is not, and there will be serious consequences. So with that, I hope we do take it a step further.
Perfect. Seeing no other questions, Representative Reinbold.
Chair Gattis, I move House Bill 233-28-LS-1109-A from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Seeing no objections, the bill's going to pass out of committee, and we'll have a brief at ease while we do some paperwork. the Education Committee back to order. And the next bill that we'll hear is HB 93. And I'm afraid to, I don't want to jinx it, but we have heard this is the charter school information that went through this committee already that mirrors the governor's bill that we passed out. And this stands alone, so it's not part of the omnibus education. So really what it does is it takes the charter school information that we passed out of committee and mirrors it separately. And I guess we do have a quorum. And I'm see if I've got staff here that can speak to the bill, and we'll try to move on as quickly as we can. I'll have my committee aide, if she'll come forward. I think we're a little lopsided. We just passed a bill that had a lot of press and a lot of pictures, and so we have some folks that are still wrapping it up. So I have my education committee aide, and if she'll introduce herself for the record and just kind of go over this bill again that we've heard before.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I'm sorry, Representative Quito, could I have you adopt the committee substitute? I think we're all kind of discombobled here because of the last, so appreciate it. Representative Quito.
Madam Chair, thank you, and for the purposes of adopting the work draft, I will move to adopt work draft 28LS0354/R as the working draft for CS for House Bill number 93.
Thank you, Representative Quito. Is there any objection? Hearing no objection, version R has been adopted.
I don't either.
Okay, we'll brief at ease. We'll go back on the record, and so folks have in front of them the version R, the CS to HB 93 28-LS0354/R, so version R. And if I can have my staff introduce herself for the record, and please walk us through this.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Crystal Kennedy, and I am staff to Representative Gaddis. As you have already been made aware, this really is a CS in this bill that mirrors much of the work that this committee did, actually all of the committee's work, in regard to the amendments to the governor's bill, House Bill 278. So with that, the first section is the component that requires that a district make its decision to deny or approve a charter application within a 60-day period. This is also the section that allows the Commissioner of the Department of Education and Early Development to be the approving authority for a charter school. And it also provides for the State Board of Education to become the operator of that charter school. The second section lays out the appeal process through the Commissioner's office. Section 3 is the committee amendment on securing a charter school's right of first refusal for leasing any available space in a school district facility or in a public facility, and allows that the district can charge a reasonable fee that reflects the true operational costs of that facility. Section 4 limits the amount that a district can charge in indirect cost fees to 4%. And it includes the language similar to that of the governor's bill 278, that's House Bill 278, that states the funding is generated also for special needs, vocational and technical instruction, and construction or major maintenance that should also be continued or be part of the funding that's directed to charter schools. Section 5 requires that school districts formulate policies and thoughtfully address the transportation challenges of their charter school districts. The district should be charged with coordinating transportation routes and transportation availability as best they can within their current transportation plan. If not, the districts will have to forfeit that portion of their transportation funds that are generated by that number of students attending the charter school and hand that money over to the charter school. It does not, however, require the district to specifically provide transportation routes for students that they do have to allow charter schools. It's really meant to just allow charter schools to take advantage of normal bus routes whenever reasonably possible. Section 6 addresses bonding by a municipality or borough for construction, additions, and major rehabilitation projects for charter schools, and it will allow for a 70% debt reimbursement of those bonds. Section 7 decreases the minimum number of students required for establishing the funding rate for a charter school within its first 3 years, and that number goes down to 75 and allows the adjusted student count to be counted at the same rate as that of for 150 students. Section 8 speaks to the repeal of the HSGQE, and then Section 9 provides for an effective date of September 1st, 2014. And with that, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Again, if this sounds familiar, folks, it's because we've been down this trail before a time or two. Representative Wilson.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I was trying to follow through with a sectional as she read it, and my section 7 doesn't correspond with her section 7, I don't think. Could you just say what I just kind of got mixed up because it wasn't section 7, my section 7, and I, oh, you know what? I am in the wrong. Let me find R. That will help.
Right. And a reminder again, we're on version R for those that are listening as well.
Okay.
And while we wait a moment, will Representative Quito.
I think I just wanted to add maybe a clarification on Section 8.
Section 8?
Section 8 of the working draft.
Uh-huh.
And that repeal, I believe, is an actual repeal of the sunset for the charter school facilities program and not the HSGQE. Is that correct?
I would have to check on that again, but that my understanding is that that was the component that related to charter schools in regard to the HSGQE, but I would okay. I can look that up and check for sure. So thank you.
Representative C.
Thank you, Madam Chair. talking about section or number 18 on page 9, subsection 18 relating to the the 70% reimbursement for schools. Since we talked on this bill, two districts have come to me and said that this creates a differential between their alternative schools and the charter schools, and that so charter schools actually can get bond reimbursement rates higher than the alternative schools. And so I wanted to bring that before the committee, because oftentimes if we're trying to have recovery schools or those kind of things or those we have a flex school in Homer, which is an alternative school. Kids that aren't performing well in the regular school can take that, and it's more, you know, flex, obviously the term named flex school tells where it is. It's still in the public school, still there, but it's a separate school. And so I'm curious as to whether, you know, we've missed that in our original version, or whether we want to talk about that as far as alternative schools also classifying for the same on reimbursement rate as we have for charter schools.
Well, Representative Seaton, as you may or may not remember, it was Representative Quito's amendment. So if Representative Quito could give us some clarification, and he certainly has some expertise, I appreciate it. Representative Quito.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And when I was looking at those particular changes, the specific issue that I was trying to address was the issue where charter schools are, in a lot of cases, in leased facilities, not in district facilities. I am not aware that very many alternative schools are in leased facilities. I think a lot of the alternative schools are already in district facilities. So it was written really to allow for a pathway for charter schools to be built and then incorporated as a district facility, so they wouldn't have those onerous lease costs.
And Representative Quito, that's exactly how I thought you presented it as well. I certainly know that in our school district, we have our charter schools are the only ones in leased buildings. So, you know, I appreciated that. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I supported that amendment, and I supported supported that idea as well. But I did want to make the committee aware that alternative schools are generally smaller than the large schools. They are trying to either recover students back in for graduation, or these are students that are going to be dropouts and they require, you know, other least separate facilities are what's happening in Homer.
So
it's actually a separate school, but the numbers on that would mean that if there's a public school system, the MATSU wants to have a recovery and making sure that we have kids that are in the dropout zone and they just don't work well in the regular public school, that if the school district would want to bond for and build a school, they would not be able to, or at least in Anchorage, they would not be able to get the 70-30. They'd be on the 60-40. And so I wanted to bring it to the committee's attention because it was brought to my attention that districts were feeling like, okay, you know, we have specialized schools with specialized missions. Charter schools are one way to get a specialized mission. The other specialized mission can be the district defining that, oh, we need to maintain these kids in school. It could be like a construction academy school because it's separate, but if it was, if you were trying to do that to keep these kids in school, you couldn't get a 70-30 bond in many districts for another school because you have adequate spacing in, you know, throughout the district compared to the district number of kids. So that's why I brought it up, is because we didn't consider that at all, and that wasn't what that particular design was.
Well, and I appreciate you bringing it, but I have to disagree with you because I know that at this time in the MATSU, we have Valley Pathways, which is an alternative school in which we have bonded for, and that school is being built right now, and it's bonded under the 70-30 as an alternative school. Now, I'm not sure what happens in your neck of the woods, if you will, but I do know that we have bonded and we were able to use the 70-30. And I think that if I could take the words out of Representative Quito's mouth, I think that what his point was, just take it right out there, I think his point was to allow charter schools to also have that opportunity. And I believe that the alternative schools certainly do, and it can be tested that it's happening right now in the MATSU.
Well, Madam Chair, I shouldn't have used the MATSU because that's the only school that's expanding, so you have available space under the 70-30 square footage. If you go to Anchorage, the Anchorage School District, you can't, doesn't matter what you're going to build, you can't build it because there's enough square footage to cover all of those kids. The Kenai Peninsula School District has been shrinking somewhat as well, so that's why you could get the 70-30 beyond the space requirements, but in most of the districts across the state, you couldn't if you were doing an alternative school.
Representative Seaton, I think if I'm hearing you correctly, you're stating that they could get the 70-30 if they had the students for it. If they don't have the students, they can't qualify, but they still want to go into an alternative program, but they have dwindling student, and so that they do have enough floor space, if you will, but not in the specific area that they found it may be needed. They could not bond for 70-30. And thank you. I understand what you're saying. I lost track of who was next. Representative Sadler.
Briefly, an observation. If most every school district is shrinking, there is more space coming available, and probably less need to build new schools for the minority that are alternative or the save schools. And if charter schools are growing, there's a larger need for charter school facilities. I think it's appropriate to sort of have this language remain the same to allow for construction, bonding, reimbursement of construction for charter schools specifically. In my district, there's a charter school that has is up against a cap, and it's important for them to have access to bonding funding for expansion.
Right. Representative Quito.
Thank you. And I think just kind of to restate, the issue that I thought we were trying to resolve in doing this was the fact that a lot of charter schools are leasing out of leased spaces, and the alternative schools have been able to accommodate with existing facilities or with other district facilities. And I think if we have declining enrollments, so for the districts that are shrinking, they're already able to actually utilize the 70-30 program to renovate an existing building to, say, accommodate an alternative program. They would not be able to use 70-30 if they are overbuilt for their district to, say, build a new small alternative school. But the way this was written was to help those charter schools that are paying lease payments to a lease facility so that those districts could then put those students that are in a leased facility into a district facility.
Madam Chair.
Representative Seaton.
Just a little further on the point, and, you know, I totally agree that what we were trying to do in here was equalize the opportunity for charter schools. What's been brought to me was that by having the alternative schools not included in there, I mean, if it was in the MAP school, it wouldn't make any difference anyway, because you have the ability for 70-30. If it's in Anchorage and they were going to do a recovery alternative school, they couldn't do it, because the overall space is available, even though it may not be like on the Kenai. You may have overall space because you've got shrinking in Seward and shrinking in Nikiski and some in Homer, but if Nanilchik and the high school there, if they were trying to do, I mean, it's not as if all of these things are spread equally over place.
I
brought it up because I didn't think that we were trying to do inequities, and where we have individualized missions like charter schools have a separate mission, that's the same thing we do with alternative schools. So I just wanted to bring it up to the committee so that we at least had the discussion.
And thank you, Mr. Seaton. I understand what you're saying at this point. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe it's section one. In section one, lays out that if there's been a denial by the local school board, the next thing you do is go to the commissioner, and if the commissioner denies it, then the locals, then the entity can go to the state school board, and then through a various number of things that can be done, then the state school board would become the board, the school board for the charter school. And I don't see anywhere in here where we change the statutes for the state school board to allow them to be now a school board for a charter school. We've changed everything and say all this can be done, but I think then we have to go in and change the laws, that the statutes that apply to charter schools, I mean to the State Board of Education.
And I'll see if my aide can speak to that. I know that we've heard many different gyrations on this. I thought that the last time that we spoke, and she'll be able to, hopefully I'm not misspeaking, Crystal. And introduce yourself again for those that are listening.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Crystal Kennedy, aide to Representative Gaddis. And through the chair, Representative Wilson, I believe that what you might be referring to is at the bottom of Section 1, Subsection G, where it says that a local school board that denied an application for a charter school approved by the state board. No, sorry, that is not the one.
Madam Chair.
Representative Seaton.
It's actually F.
Okay, good.
The one right before that, yes.
So can you
again,
share with
section
us
one,
page number?
Okay, we're on page 2 and the subsection F that begins at line 17. Except as provided in subsection G of this section, the state board shall operate a charter school that has been approved by the state board on appeal of a denial of the charter school application by the local school board under the laws governing the operation and maintenance of a charter school as if the state board were a school district.
So, follow up.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, AS 1403255 through somewhere then that statute got changed, because right now it doesn't say they can operate it. So that's what I'm asking. Does that section say that now they can do that?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Gaddison, it would probably be a better question for DEED to address specifically, because that would definitely be my assumption. But I think if you want clarification, you need DEED.
Okay, we'll hold that question to ask them where it is. Representative Quito.
I was actually going to weigh in a little bit.
Please
on
weigh
that,
in.
But I would just say that the Department of Education right now does operate the Mount Edgecombe Boarding School as a public school. And the Department of Education also has the ability to take over operations of schools that are underperforming. So the department can clarify more, but I do believe they have the ability to operate a school.
You're probably right. Yeah.
Good statement. Thank you very much for helping my bill here. Any other questions at this point or comments? Representative Wilson.
And Madam Chair, in the I think it must be Section 7 or something like that. Let's see. Try to go back and find it. Yes, in Section 7, if a charter school has a student count of more than 74 but less than 150 for the current year and is in the first 3 years of operation or had a student count of at least 75 or more in the previous year, they can... essentially, that says that they can use a count for 3 years. They can use that count if they're under 75. However, in small school districts, in Ketchikan, for instance, right now, they would like to start two more charter schools, but they can't because of the fact that they don't. In other words, sometimes in a smaller school district, you might only have 10 kids in one class, and maybe you might have 15 in that next class, and they go all the way up. Well, there are charter schools that are K-6, and so they can't get that number of 150, no matter how hard they try. And so can we a lower amount for schools that aren't K-12? Charter schools, so that we could allow charter schools to become charter schools if they're always below that number.
Representative Wilson, if I'm hearing you correctly, you're asking to change the count that a charter school needs in order to be a charter school. Mm-hmm. To a lower number than the bill indicates.
Yes.
And I personally have no problem with that. I don't know what the ramifications. Certainly there's always financial ramifications to that. Representative Quito may be able to shed some light.
I don't know. I think the department would be more appropriate to answer
sure.
that, but I would have a concern that if we allow charter schools to be established with too few students, that the operational cost of that facility, either the lease or the utility payments, would be excessive in comparison to the number of students being served. So if the schools are too small, it would be difficult to operate with the amount of money received in the BSA for a very small number of students. So I don't know what that dividing line is in the department. should probably talk a little more to that.
And Representative Quito, to that matter, though, I would have to say if you can't afford to operate, then I guess you're not operating. So that particular point will be solved by the fact that you don't have the money to operate. I mean, I guess that's, I'm just thinking out loud, certainly how came Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, my school district let me know that this is, this provision on one charter school in the Kenai Peninsula is going to require the district to transfer to that charter school, who they approved, $200,000 more per year than they had anticipated, because a small school size level gets more funding because it is inefficient to operate, so less efficient to operate. So if we put this size down, it means that we are going to say that we are going to have that school size factor is going to come in, and so the school district that is authorizing the charter school is going to have to put those inefficiencies into the school because it's a small school, and they're going to have to pay for that based on the school size formula and pay them more per student than current. And just, I was not aware of the magnitude of the change that we did, but it was $200,000 for a single charter school in the Kenai Peninsula borough what there's one that's in that realm.
Okay, and we'll take a brief at ease. Back on the record. And I don't even remember where we are. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to, on page 10, line 1, I would, is it time to offer an amendment?
It's time. We've got 11 minutes, and so no time like the present.
Okay, I would like to offer amendment number 1 and
conceptual amendment number 1.
Yeah, conceptual amendment number 1 would delete that first 3 years of operation so that they could have it all the time, because for the smaller school districts, and especially if they want to have a charter school that is K-6, they can't do it because they can't get up to that number of 150. So I would like to delete the number of 150 and make it 75. And that's a conceptual amendment.
I understand that. And I'll object for discussion purposes, and I'd like to bring the department forward, because I understand, Representative Wilson, where you're coming from. It's the unintended consequences or the intended consequences of this portion that I want to be sure that we were aware of. And you know the drill.
For the record, Susan McCauley, Department of Education, and Early Development Director of Teaching and Learning Support. And I'm going to readily admit that this is not my area of expertise. This is a school finance consideration with a potential fiscal note implication with that amendment. And so I don't know what the impact of that is. I understand the sentiment. I understand that it is trying to remove a potential barrier that putting in place that 150 creates. We do have, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 charter schools currently consistently for a long period of time operating under the 150 mark. And when that is occurring, there have been circumstances created in collaboration with their districts to support their operation. I'm aware of one, for example, that is operating in a district facility. So that would remove some of the necessary economies of scale that would be needed in order to support facility costs. But I just don't know the implications, fiscal implications, for districts or in general of that amendment.
I appreciate your honesty. Representative Quito.
Thank you. And I also don't know what the fiscal implications are, but I do believe that the fiscal formulas that we're impacting are in Section 14.17.440. And for a student population between 75 and 150, we have a base amount of 122.85. And for a student population between 150 and 250, we have a base amount of 218. So what we're saying is that for that student population between 75 and 150 for charter schools, they would permanently be receiving a base of 218 instead of 122.
So that certainly speaks to the fiscal note itself. As the bill sponsor, I certainly have no problem with that, and I have the financial expert has just blown into the door. May not even know the question, but if she'd like to come to the hot seat. And we'll repeat the question. You'll know this off the top of your head, I'm sure. Thank you, Ms. Noodleman, and I'm not sure if you heard the question, and that's the reason that you came to us, and we appreciate that. Representative Wilson, can you repeat the question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just was wondering what the ramifications would be, and I've done a conceptual amendment that would change the number of students required in a charter school from 150 to 75. Because the smaller school districts, it's very, and I've got in Ketchikan, the superintendent has asked me to do this because they've got some K-12 or K-6 people that would want to have a charter school, but they can never get that 150 ever because it's only for seven grades, number one, and number two, because of that, they aren't even doing it, but they want to.
Okay, thank you.
And if you'll introduce yourself, thank you.
Elizabeth Noodleman, Director of School Finance. And through the chair, Representative Wilson, I'll just speak a little bit to the school size table. My understanding is a proposal currently on the table is to provide for an average daily membership beginning at this count of 75 for charter schools during their first 3 years, or if the charter school was at 75 in the previous year. And so what that really provides for is an opportunity for charter schools with an average daily membership of 75 to receive increased funding and grow if there's an opportunity to grow and remain at 75 if that's as high as the membership goes. And so it's my understanding that is the current proposal, and charter schools could operate at average daily membership of 75 and be funded at a higher level than they currently are.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
It says that for the first 3 years, on page 10, line 1, it says, and is in the first 3 years of operation or had a student count of at least 75 in the previous year. So after those first 3 years, then I don't think the bill it doesn't allow for that except for the first 3 years.
And through the chair, Representative Wilson, in the first 3 years of operation or had a student count of at least 75 in the previous year of operation. And so it is my understanding that once the charter school reaches the 75 and maintains the 75, they continue to be funded at a level that's higher than what is currently in law.
Okay. I see where that said. I believe you're right, because that or does say that. So thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
I withdraw my amendment.
Then. Oh, okay. So to be real clear, Representative Wilson has withdrawn her conceptual amendment number one. Representative Ledoux.
So I'm just trying to figure out if a charter school, maybe the founders of the charter school want a small charter school for maybe kindergarten through grade three or something, and they want to keep it small. Do they get anything?
Again, through the chair, Representative Ledoux. Yes, charter schools of any size are funded through several opportunities in the funding chart, and I believe that the lowest funding for the charter school would be an increase of 1.18 per ADM, which is in addition, it's a larger increase than just funding for the ADM. It goes through the size chart, and there is an increase for a very small charter school.
So you follow up through the chair?
Please, Representative Ledoux.
So you could have a charter school. You could. Maybe there's a difference in funding between that and a larger charter school of 25 to 50 kids.
Through the chair, correct. You could have a charter school, and you could receive 1.18 increment for funding. Of course, you would have to have a model that provided for everything that the parents and students wanted in that charter school. So there would be some practical considerations.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? Well, you guys are easy today. We've closed public testimony on this. We closed public testimony when we spoke about it in House Bill 278. Again, it mirrors House Bill 278 that we really spent a lot of due diligence and time going through. So with that, I'll bring you back to the committee. And Representative Reinbold.
Madam Chair, I move.
Yep.
Is that what you want me to do? This is an amendment. Yep.
Little bit of housekeeping here. There is an effective date on this that mirrored the governor's bill, as we called it, and so we do need to make an amendment on that before we move the bill.
Madam Chair, I move to amend Committee Substitute House Bill 93 to change the effective date from September 1st, 2014 to July 1st, 2014.
And to remind folks here, we did the same thing. We looked at that reporting measure from September to July. And I think that it has something to do with the HSGQE aspect. It's just a reminder.
Could you restate the amendment, please?
Madam Chair, I move to amend Committee Substitute House Bill 93 to change the effective date from September 1st, 2014 to July 1st, 2014.
I object for discussion.
Thank you. We have an objection for discussion, and I'm going to have my committee aide speak to that, because even though she's written me a really nice note, I'm not sure that I can speak to it as clearly as she can. And thank you again for moving from side to side, getting a workout this morning. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Crystal Kennedy. Legislative staff to Representative Gaddis, and the question in regard to the amendment and the reason for the date, there were certain dates that work better for school districts, and usually they're all on a fiscal year of July 1st. Specifically, it helped to mirror some of the other things that were actually, like you said, done in the governor's bill. So this would allow for any changes that would occur, because you're changing the count, like the student count, for instance. This would help them in formulating their budget for that particular year if you allow them to start on July 1st versus September 1st when school's already started. So,
Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That does not give the department very much time to, they have to write regulations for this, I believe. And will that give them enough time to write those regulations? Because that's not very long, really.
Well, I guess we still have the department here, and I'll ask them to come forward. Chris, don't move, because I'm sure you'll be back. this particular subject did not come up that it was a problem in the last bill, and I quite frankly have forgotten what the reasoning behind it. Could you give us the page and the and the line number so we can follow it too? Page and line number, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Madam Chair, the page is page 10, section 10. This act takes effect September 1st, 2014. Your amendment was to change that date to July 1st.
Thank you. And Dr. McCauley, are you with us? I mean, I know that we've been flipping pages.
Yes. Again, for the record, Susan McCauley, Department of Education and Early Development. Sorry, just give me a moment. I want to think this through.
Okay, well, we'll give you a moment. We'll take a brief at ease. And I know that we've been through a lot of gyrations with the last bill, and quite frankly, we don't remember what the date did. It seemed to be important last time around, but Representative Wilson has raised some concerns that it would take some time with regulation, and I would ask Representative Reinbold.
Madam Chair, I move to withdraw this amendment.
Okay, so... we're actually waiting for an objection to be withdrawn, correct? Representative Seaton.
I was going to object to the withdrawal.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
And I want to speak to the objection. So, you know, if we're looking at the calculation in the formula, if that's the portion that we're looking at, I think that maybe we should ask.
Representative Seaton, could you say that again? I didn't quite catch you. I mean,
if the regulation change we're talking about is something that is just an application to the formula, then that may not require separate regulations.
Well, and Representative Seaton, I think we've gone beyond that. I think okay. That what it is that we've decided that we're going to withdraw that amendment that we really felt was just a cleanup date taking from September to July, and
I'll withdraw my objection.
Thank you. I think we've gotten. I'm going to look at Kelly, the maestro. Where are we in this?
We are withdrawing amendment number 2.
Thank you. So Representative Reinbold has asked to withdraw amendment number 2. Seeing no objection, we have withdrawn that amendment. And now the Representative Reinbold.
Madam Chair, I move to move committee substitute House Bill 93, number 28LS0354-R out of committee as amended with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal note.
Seeing no objections, it has moved. And with that, if you'll please stay long enough to sign the paperwork. Today's Friday. We'll meet again on Monday. And we're winding down here, folks. So I think that next week will be our last education committee week, and we may be even done by Wednesday. So thank you very much, and we'll see you on Monday.